Our doctor is in, and so are the doctors of Capital Health. Welcome to the all-new Health 411. Every Sunday morning at 10, Dr. Jonathan Karp, along with our respected panel of guests from Capital Health, take you on an important medical journey to help you navigate your health and the healthcare system to reach your destination, good health. Health 411 is underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine. Capital Health is the region's leader in providing progressive quality patient care with exceptional physicians, nurses, and staff, as well as advanced technology.
107.7 The Bronx and 107.7TheBronx.com. We are nominated for National Association of Broadcasters 2019, 2021, 2022, and 2023, 4 years in a row. Marconi Award for Best College Radio Station, as well as a winner of the 2023 IBS College Media Award for Universities Under 10,000 Students. We are broadcasting from the Bronx All Digital Studios at Rider University in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Welcome to Health 411. I am your host of Health 411, Professor Jonathan Karp. This Health 411 program is presented by Capital Health. Here we discuss a variety of issues affecting health and wellness, public health, healthcare policy, and the science of health and healthcare. Our goal is to expand your knowledge and perspective and give you some things to think about. Today, Dan Geller, our student producer, senior biochemistry major, and I are going to have a conversation about a topic that Dan picked that he wanted to talk about. He wanted to talk about something called the brain microbiome. And just to put it in context, the microbiome that is in your gut is very popular right now.
It is. There's been a lot of new research showing that either the bacteria themselves, the bacterial metabolites, have some effect on various pathophysiologies.
Cool. So tell me what you know before we begin to talk about the possibility of a nervous system or brain microbiome. What do you know about the gut microbiome, which is a very, very hot topic now and has been for the past five-ish kind of years?
So it's very important. You know, we've seen a lot of different types of bacteria in the gut, obviously, and there's a lot more bacterial cells in you and on you than there are human cells. So actually, you're more bacteria than you are human. And so obviously, all of these little organisms are implicated in various things, you know, including behavior, mood, that sort of thing.
Well, I wouldn't say obviously, because the number of cells that of any sort do not necessarily reflect on like function. No one says number relates to function. People talk about structure. You could have very, very few cells of a something in you can have a profound effect on physiology and behavior. So I'm not sure the number of cells is what's important.
So it's what they're doing.
Yes, because let's be a little sciencey, right? Mm-hmm. So it's what the cells are doing, and what kind of things does the gut microbiome do?
So part of it is it transmits messages up the vagus nerve, right? You can have bacteria.
Let's take a step back. The gut microbiome includes bacteria, but it also includes, I guess, there's a virome, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also the microbes, humus, and things like that, and there's two possibilities, right? You have these organisms in your gut, and they are living organisms, and those things are going to generate metabolic byproducts. They're going to be dividing. They're metabolic byproducts. Some of those sort of things can directly or indirectly influence normal sort of human and animal physiology and behavior. For example, some of those things can get into our nervous system by different routes. The vagus nerve is one of them. But sometimes the way the microbiome affects us, our physiology and behavior, is not necessarily by what the microbes are releasing. Sometimes our physiology and behavior can be influenced by our body's response to the microbes.
So like inflammation.
Inflammation sort of is can be. Let's talk about one that's a little bit more specific, because inflammation can be a lot of different things in different compartments. For example, have you ever had a fever?
Yes.
You got you have a bacterial infection and you have a fever. Well, what causes your body temperature rise?
Indirectly, the bacteria. But there's obviously mechanisms associated with.
My point is, what happens is, what causes your body temperature to rise is cells of your immune system recognize the bacteria, right? And they, especially some of the, we'll have to go into in immunology, but there's a cytokine, a chemical released by, you know, cells.
We hear about the cytokine storm a lot associated with illness.
The cytokine storm can be sort of deadly, but just let's call about more simple, a fever, right? You get like these pro-inflammatory cytokines like IL-1, tumor necrosis factor alpha. And these sort of things can get up into your brain and affect the body temperature portions of your brain that are in your hypothalamus. So it's, yes, you have a bacterial infection that causes a rise in body temperature, but the signals to doing that aren't coming directly from the bacteria. The signals that are rising temperature are actually the pro-inflammatory cytokines that are generated by your immune response to, for example, components of the, you know, gram-negative cell wall kind of thing.
Okay, and so that's produced by white blood cells?
Lymphocytes, which
okay.
I guess technically a type of white blood cell. Mm-hmm. But my point being for today's discussion is if when we talk about the gut microbiome, we're talking about the microbes. Let's just call them the prokaryotes, the bacteria that are in your gut. The things that they release that could have an effect.
Are they all prokaryotic?
Well, bacteria are.
Okay. Is there eukarya in the gut?
There could be eukaryotic. They would be part of the microbiome. Mm-hmm. Technically, I guess that wouldn't be a good thing to sort of have, but it could, okay. it could be. I am not a microbiologist that knows every in and out of different kinds of microbes that are there. That could be a homework assignment for you. So the point being is that these microbes can release things that can influence human and animal physiology and behavior. Also, sometimes human and animal physiology and behavior can be altered by the response, the immune system response to these sort of things. That's what I was trying to get you to point out.
It was just fair. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cool. What else do you know about the gut microbiome?
So I talked about the vagus nerve a little bit earlier.
What is the vagus nerve?
It's a nerve that goes from the gut to the brain, essentially. And it's associated with a variety of things. Like people used to do vagotomies.
They still do them.
Yeah, but it used to be much more widespread because we didn't understand how important the vagus nerve really was. People would do it to lower acid reflux.
Okay, so the vagus nerve is one of the cranial nerves. It comes off the ventral surface of the brainstem. And it's called the vagus nerve because early anatomists noticed it innervated a lot of the organs of the body, right? And so it was named the wandering nerve. Vagus like means wandering, right? And it's part of the parasympathetic nervous system, right? Which means...
Let's go through the difference between sympathetic, parasympathetic.
I have to. So the parasympathetic nervous system, of which the vagus nerve is one of them, has its cell bodies up in the cranial nerves or down in the sacrum.
And the axon is what shoots down through the body.
Correct. Right. So that's the nerve.
Right.
And a nerve is a collection of like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of axons kinds of things. And the cell bodies, I believe, are in something called the nucleus of the solitary tract, sort of in the brainstemish brain area. But be that may, the vagus nerve is innervating almost all the organs of your body. And it innervates them by putting acetylcholine on them, right? Which is the major neurotransmitter there. What's interesting about the vagus is it's both a sensory and motor nerve, which means some information from these target organs, whether it's your heart, your lungs, your spleen, right? Some of that information comes from the target organ back up into your nervous system, in addition to information going from the nervous system out to the target organs. So the vagus nerves have both components. Carry on. Tell me more.
So I am in a class called Nature and Nurture, and we talk about behavior as it relates to actual science. Okay.
Okay.
And so one of the things we talked about was the gut microbiome. And it was actually shown that when you have certain bacteria in the gut, it is transmitted up through the brain, through the vagus nerve, mm-hmm. and it has various purposes in the brain.
And some of those things that are traveling from the periphery up are pro-inflammatory cytokines, mm-hmm. for example. That's mm-hmm. why I wanted to introduce that. But it's not... not necessarily something that the vagus nerve is making or the bacteria are making. It's that it's transporting up some of the cytokines produced by the lymphocytes back up into the central nervous system.
Yeah, and so there was an experiment that showed that when you have mice that are just fed normal broth versus mice that are fed something with lactobacillus in it, which is a bacteria, mm-hmm. that the mice fed with the lactobacillus are a lot less prone to stress and things like that. So we can see that the microbiome has some sort of effect on behavior as well.
Yes.
Not just pathophysiology.
That's why I kept saying physiology
exactly.
and behavior. And we know that from practical experience because what's going on in your gut can influence mood and affect and a whole bunch of other things like that.
I mean, yeah, you could just, you talk about people being hangry, you know.
I don't talk like that, but TV commercials do yeah, things like that.
Need a Snickers.
Yeah, well,
we
could talk about that. But first, let's take a break for our underwriting, Dan, and we'll be right back with Health 411. You're listening to 107.7 The Bronx and 107.7 The Bronx.
Health 411 Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. on 107.7 The Bronx is underwritten by Capital Health. If someone you loved was sick, how far would you go to make sure they got the best care? Your mother, your sister, your best friend, your neighbor, your son? How far would you go for doctors who will meet with you longer so they really get to know you and who collaborate across disciplines so that they can devise a plan of care that's uniquely right for you? There's no doctor too far, no care too distant that you wouldn't go there. And for more than 100 years, so has Capital Health. From our hospitals in Trenton and Hopewell to our primary care offices all across Mercer, Bucks, and Burlington counties to right here at Rider University, Capital Health has the team of doctors, nurses, experts, specialists, and staff that you can count on to care as much about your loved ones as you do. Because you'd go to the ends of the earth if someone you loved was sick. And so do we, Capital Health. There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
107.7 The Bronx and 107.7TheBronx.com. Welcome back. I'm Professor Jonathan Karp, and here on Health 411, Dan and I are having a conversation about the microbiomes in the body. And Dan did a quick overview of some things he's learning about the gut microbiome and behavior, and we can have a whole other show on that, which is sort of interesting. And we know that things that the microbes that are in our body, either directly or indirectly, can influence what's happening in the nervous system. And this has made at least a couple people think about the possibility of different compartments in the body that might have their own microbiome. There might be like a microbiome of the gut, but the possibility exists. And this is what you brought to me that you wanted to talk about. You wanted to sort of have the Health 411 program on the possibility of a brain microbiome. Mm-hmm. Now, what about that did you find sort of interesting?
I sort of just understood that we have so many bacterial cells that live in and on our body, right? And so it would kind of make sense that you have bacterial cells in the brain. But at the same time,
why would it make sense to you? Because I disagree with you.
You disagree with me?
I disagree. Why do you think
if they're everywhere, why wouldn't they be there?
Well, that's one of the things. Are they everywhere? And do you know about this thing called the blood-brain barrier?
I do.
Okay, and in your mind, what is the blood-brain barrier?
It's sort of the lining of the artery that goes through the brain that only allows certain things to come through.
Okay, so let's work with that. It's a lining of endothelial cells with very, very tight junctions, mm-hmm, right? And so what happens is that creates a compartmentalization in the brain. So the extracellular fluid of the brain, of the central nervous system, and the brain spinal cord too, but let's just use the word brain, is different than the extracellular fluid of the blood, mm-hmm, right? Now, in terms of physiology, is that an important conceptual thing to have?
Yes.
Why?
Because you can't just have anything flowing in and out of the brain. You need some sort of control.
What is the job of the central nervous system and brain?
To take sensory input and translate it into action.
Correct. Yes, in a simple sense. To collect in sensory input, integrate it with what's going on in the body, and produce appropriate behavior. I would argue that in order for the nervous system to produce appropriate behavior, it has to be it has to work in an environment that's very, very constant. It can't be changing relative to when the last time you ate was, when the last time you had sex, what kind of happening in your blood, all the things that vary in your blood all the time. Hormones turn on, hormones turn off, things are secreted, things are inhibited. You need an environment that's relatively constant in an ever-changing world to have some sort of consistency to behavior, right? Mm-hmm. And the cells of your central nervous system, the neurons and glia, are very, very sensitive to the composition of the extracellular space, especially the ions that are floating around and all that kind of stuff. It's sort of the ionic basis of action potentials. And
you have to have constant things to have constant action potentials that work cohesively.
Correct, and you need sort of a stability there. And so in terms of evolution, at least the evolution of vertebrates, evolved this process where your central nervous system works in an environment that's for the most part isolated from what's in your blood. That's not to say the blood-brain barrier is the Great Wall of China. It does monitor what's happening in the blood. And there are, I don't know, 5 or 7 places where the blood-brain barrier is weak, whether it's the area postrema, the circumventricular organs,
So there are parts of the blood-brain barrier that are not as...
There are holes,
quote-unquote holes
in the blood-brain barrier where your nervous system is monitoring what's in the blood. Mm-hmm. For example, if you eat bad shrimp, your nervous system is going to monitor the toxins that are in the blood and cause you to vomit mm-hmm. and throw up before you've like digested all that shrimp. So it gets it out of your stomach and get out of your body. So it's monitoring what's in your blood all the time. And that's the area posterior. But that's just one of the many circumventricular organs of the blood-brain barrier where there are holes. So it's mm-hmm. there are some places, but there's special things going out. Now, in that concept, I want to come back to the idea. You said, it just makes sense that there'd be microbes in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to probe that. So tell me, I interrupted you. Tell me more just makes sense to you.
What I said earlier, right, is that the vagus nerve transmits bacteria into the brain, correct?
It does not transport the bacteria themselves.
Not themselves?
No. It's as far as I know, it's transporting things that the bacteria make or the things that the immune system makes in response to the bacteria being there. That doesn't mean there couldn't be bacteria that actually do retrograde transport.
Because that's something I read, that I didn't know it was called retrograde transport, but that they do travel up the vagus nerve and eventually end up in the brain. So that's why it made sense to me, because I thought that was a mechanism. I might be wrong.
You might be thinking about, so there are some neuroinvasive viruses and stuff out there, like the herpes virus family. Those are viruses that target neurons, and they go into neurons, and they sort of lie dormant there for long periods of time until they're like reactivated. And you know, the chickenpox virus is one of them, but so is like herpes 1, herpes 2. There's 8 or 10 of different kinds of herpes, kinds of viruses, kinds of things.
And you also mentioned that there's holes, quote unquote holes, in the blood-brain barrier.
There are.
Right? And so I'd assume that some bacteria do get through those holes. And although...
I wouldn't say holes. It's where the blood-brain barrier
is. So what's the scientific term for where the blood-brain barrier is thinner?
They're called the circumventricular organs.
The circumventricular
organs.
They
tend to be around the ventricles.
All right, I call them the COs.
CVOs.
CVOs. So the CVOs.
Yes.
Right? So... Why can't bacteria get through that?
Well, let's dissect that a little bit. The idea would be bacteria, when they're alive, are cells. They're alive, correct?
Correct.
Most bacteria, and I can think of one or two exceptions to this, but they're not. Most bacteria being cells that are alive. Not only are they metabolically active, but they do things like bacteria do. It's like they divide. Right? Some bacteria divide on every 7 minutes, every 20 minutes, every 90 minutes, blah, 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 blah. Whatever the number is, right? They're dividing and dividing and dividing. One of the hallmarks of the central nervous system is there's not a whole lot of cell division going on. And one of the reasons for that is there's no room for it. The central nervous system is sort of covered by bone, and things can't expand. There can't be inflammation in the brain. Well, encephalitis there can be, but it's like deadly. It can kill you. It's not like having a swollen knee or an ankle or something like that. If inflammation gets in the brain, it's deadly. It prevents.
Yeah, that's one of the concerns with concussions.
Yes, is that there is some
second
sort of
impact syndrome.
And you get up this buildup of pressure, mm-hmm. and since your head can't expand when there's bone there, any fluid buildup would push back on the brain tissue and destroy normal brain tissue, which interferes the ability for the nervous system to do its job. So I would argue that having any sort of immune response in the brain is not a thing that can happen because it would kill the organism. That being said, there's a long history of people considering the brain and the central nervous system as what's sometimes called as an immune privileged organ. Not that immune-like responses are absent, because there are certainly microglial cells in the brain. But the idea is that the normal cells that are components of the human immune response or the animal immune response, those cells are not in the brain as far as people know, under healthy conditions. There are not circulating lymphocytes or macrophages or eosinophils and those sort of things that are in the blood that are sort of surveilling and having immune responses all over the body all the time. Those sort of things, for the most part, don't really exist in the brain. That doesn't mean, this is something we can talk about going forward, that there aren't some sort of microbes in there. And like, what would they look like and what would you have to look like to find them?
Because we have found them. And so
let's get back to that. Running out of time. So we have they been found under some very specific conditions? The answer is yes. But let's talk about what that may be. And we'll be right back with a continuation of this conversation on Health 411 after some underwriting announcements. You're listening to 107.7 The Bronx and 107.7 The Bronx.
Health 411 Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. on 107.7 The Bronx is underwritten by Capital Health. If someone you loved was sick, how far would you go to make sure they got the best care? Your mother, your sister, your best friend, your neighbor, your son? How far would you go for doctors who will meet with you longer so they really get to know you and who collaborate across disciplines so that they can devise a plan of care that's uniquely right for you? There's no doctor too far, no care too distant, that you wouldn't go there. And for more than 100 years, so has Capital Health. From our hospitals in Trenton and Hopewell, to our primary care offices all across Mercer, Bucks, and Burlington counties, to right here at Rider University, Capital Health has the team of doctors, nurses, experts, specialists, and staff that you can count on to care as much about your loved ones as you do. Because you'd go to the ends of the earth if someone you loved was sick. And so do we, Capital Health.
There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
7.7 The Bronx and 107.7thebronx.com. We are recording Health 411 from the Digital Bronx Studios. I'm Professor Jonathan Karp, and I'm continuing my conversation with Dan Geller, our student producer, who is intrigued by the idea of a brain microbiome. And at the last segment, Dan very impulsively shouted out, "But oh my God, microbes have been found like in the brain." And like, we didn't have time to go into it, but I am taking pause with that statement. Why do you think I'm taking pause with that statement, Dan?
Because like you said, it's only under specific conditions we found them, and you can't just broadly say there are microbes in the brain.
Correct. Let's look at some of the evidence, and you gave me a paper to read and it talked about some of the stuff, but what's in there, and this is sort of what my instinct would be too, is like if you assayed central nervous system tissue, right, and you started looking for microbes, yeah, you might find, you know, microbes in there. You're not going to find big pockets of them and big pus-like things, just because, like I said, there's no room for
unless you have like a brain abscess.
Yeah, or something like that, which is an abnormal. But that's an important part, because most of the evidence that has found microbes in the brain or bits and pieces of microbes, like they look for, you're not necessarily going to find a bacterial cell in there that's living there, that's sort of resident. But what might you find?
The metabolites. More broadly, things it produces, like microvesicles, the RNA, microRNA, things like that.
Well, I would say what you would find are things like ribosomal RNA,
okay,
which are from the ribosomes of the bacteria, and like, or the small subunit of the ribosomes, if you remember some basic biology, because bacteria can do that DNA makes RNA makes protein thing, and if they're gobbled up or something, you have bits and pieces of the bacteria that are there. So the kinds of places where you find evidence of microbes there tend to be in diseased brains.
Okay.
So you can find them in brains of people who have HIV, right? Brains of people who have AIDS. You can find them in some or a lot of later stage Alzheimer's disease kind of thing. But that doesn't mean that these evidence of bacteria being there or having been there are in healthy brains. And that's a big, big difference, because a lot of diseases are, even aging itself, is associated with permeability changes in the blood-brain barrier.
Well, let's define healthy then. What does a healthy brain mean?
Undiseased.
Undiseased.
Well, somebody with Alzheimer's disease is a diseased brain.
Right.
If you have let's say HIV, right? Some of those things are nervous system deficit. That's a diseased brain. Even if you have, like, and there aren't a lot of them, like, I don't know, one or just a couple people a year die of, like, herpes encephalitis a year in the United States. Those are that's a diseased brain. Those are diseased brain. I'm not talking about somebody who has attention deficit disorder or somebody with schizophrenia or some. As far as we know, those even are not associated with.
Those diseases are not associated with microbes in the brain.
Yeah, as far as anybody knows. So when we talk about healthy brain tissue, we're talking about non-pathological conditions, right? Are there compromises in the blood-brain barrier when that happens? Yeah, sometimes. But there's also a big problem, and how do you do those assays, right? As the article point out, if you're just going to take brain tissue, it's often mixed in with some blood, right?
Right, and so now you have blood, and now the blood does has microbes in it, you know?
Yeah, right. There's like, you know, I don't know, 10 to 6, 20, 10 to the 7, you know, microbes per ml of blood. There's a lot of them. Mm-hmm. There's a lot.
Does that count the microbes that you are that make you up, like red blood cells, white blood cells? Do we consider those microbes in that context?
No. Red blood cells and white blood cells are part of you.
Okay, so
they're eukaryotic cells.
So we could say like, just microbes that are not, because they're still microbes, right?
Let's use the word prokaryotes.
Okay.
Right? Because you know, just a small cell doesn't make it a microbe.
Right.
We're basically talking about bacteria here, because talking about it in the context of viruses, I mean, I brought up like HIV and herpes. That might have been the best one, because that's sort of like the there's a whole different thing of the viral equivalent of the.
And I guess we're sort of just talking about the prokaryota in the brain, not the viruses in the
correct.
Brain.
Correct. Right. We're essentially talking about bacteria.
Although every bacteria has how many viruses associated with it on average?
I don't know.
Very many.
But they're different things.
Right.
Right. They're different. They're different. You know, it's our virus is alive. I mean, it has some of the characteristics of life, but not others. They can't reproduce on their own. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, that's a whole
thing. Do you consider mitochondria alive?
No,
right.
Well, no, because they're a subcellular, they can't exist on their own. They're a subcellular component of human and bacterial cells. But we're digressing a little bit. In terms of the possibility of a brain microbiome, right? If you're going to assay brain tissue and look for evidence of microbes being there or having been there, being their bits and pieces, like ribosomal RNA, sometimes you have to be really careful how you collect the tissue, because if you're going to get brain tissue out, it's often contaminated with blood from the person or animal it's come from. And therefore, you might have something show up in your assay, but it's not endogenous to the tissue you're assaying. Furthermore, some of the studies in the review article you gave me pointed out, some of the studies that have found evidence of microbes in tissue, the evidence is actually artifactual, because sometimes unless you're doing these assays under like sterile conditions, right, things can be, they call it the kitome, is that things are in the kits.
The kitome.
All the things that you're using to do your assay have to be sort of certified, you know,
completely sterile, nothing there.
Correct.
At all.
Right.
And is it possible to achieve total sterility?
Sure.
Like complete, like on Earth, you can assure throughout an experiment like this, maybe, that everything is totally sterile. Because there must be some margin of error for it.
Yeah. I mean, you can't prove a negative, but then again, there are devices like autoclaves and stuff that sterilize surgical instruments and can sterilize a whole bunch of stuff. But, you know, do autoclaves kill prions, you know?
Can prions be killed is
the
question.
No, because they're not alive.
Exactly.
You can't kill something that's not alive.
Prions are a cool topic, too.
Which is a whole different one.
Yes.
But the idea is, like, can you remove every potential pathogen? Probably not. But you can do things that will kill anything that was alive, right? No, like, think about doing surgery. They can do surgery if they use clean instruments and clean tools and clean gloves. People don't get infections. Right? Does it mean there are no bacteria and things in there? Oh, there's probably some, but, you know, and so, yeah, but if you're going to do these assays, if you're going to look for them, remember, you can't prove a negative in science, right? But what you can do is you can do assays and be very, very careful and very, very precise about what you're measuring. And so right now, when people have looked at healthy tissue in humans, there's always been the possibility of contamination due to the kits and the reagents. And sometimes people have found that out, right? Makes you think, if there's going to be a microbiome in the brain of people, you would think it'd also be in the microbiome of the brain of animals and stuff. So one theoretically could do some animal research on this kind of stuff. Like some of the studies you mentioned before about, you know, looking at, you know, the components that, you know, some of these lactobacillus bacteria might produce going up the vagus nerve, those are probably done in what are called like certified pathogen-free mice and things like that. And then you can feed them these controlled diets.
I don't know. It was like C71, M71 mice. I don't know if you're familiar with the strains
of mice.
That's
just the strain, but I'm talking about the environment.
The environment. Oh, so it's separate. Okay.
Right. There's these germ-free environments, but they're not completely germ-free, because there are still a microbiome of the gums and stuff like that.
I mean, yeah, different microbiomes throughout the body, right?
Microbiomes of the bones,
you know.
Or perhaps the bones.
Perhaps.
I don't know.
I've never heard of that either. Just thinking out loud.
You just made that up. But the idea is that if there's a compartmentalization, like there is in the gums, the gut, there's probably a biome of your nasal passages. It's dynamic. It's changing. Cell number goes up. And so you have cells being born, doing their things, dying and living. All that kind of stuff can't happen in the central nervous system, which is sort of an immune privileged state, and you need a consistency of the extracellular environment for the nervous system to do its job. When it can't do its job, you have severe pathology and you have death. And that's a fun thing to end the segment on, but we want to think about that, and we're going to come back for our next segment on Health 411, and we'll be right back. You are listening to 107.7 The Bronx and 107.7 The Bronx.
Health 411 Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. on 107.7 The Bronx is underwritten by Capital Health. If someone you loved was sick, how far would you go to make sure they got the best care? Your mother, your sister, your best friend, your neighbor, your son? How far would you go for doctors who will meet with you longer so they really get to know you and who collaborate across disciplines so that they can devise a plan of care that's uniquely right for you? There's no doctor too far, no care too distant that you wouldn't go there. And for more than 100 years, so has Capital Health. From our hospitals in Trenton and Hopewell to our primary care offices all across Mercer, Bucks, and Burlington counties to right here at Rider University, Capital Health has the team of doctors, nurses, experts, specialists, and staff that you can count on to care as much about your loved ones as you do. Because you'd go to the ends of the earth if someone you loved was sick. And so do we, Capital Health.
There's no appointment needed for this doctor's visit. Now back to the all-new Health 411, underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine.
107.7 The Bronx and 107.7thebronx.com. Welcome back to Health 411. We're recording it today from the Digital Bronx Studios. And today, Dan and I are continuing our conversation about the possibility of a brain microbiome. And you had a question in the breakdown that you wanted to sort of ask me.
So, Dr. Karp, are you saying that under undiseased conditions, the brain is essentially sterile?
It depends what you mean by sterile.
What do you mean by sterile? There are no, like, obviously, a sterile brain means a brain with no living cells. But I mean sterile.
Well, your brain is full of living
cells. Exactly. So I'm saying, besides my cells, are there any other cells in the brain under normal conditions? Microbes, prokaryota.
Well, that's an interesting question, because that's one of the things you can look for. Your brain certainly has cells that can act like cells of the immune system. Your immune system has a cell called a macrophage. These things circulate. They're monocytes. When they start engulfing things and chopping them up, they become macrophages. Some people think that a type of glial cell in your brain called a microglial cell is a macrophage that's trapped behind the blood-brain barrier during embryological development, because microglial cells, one of the subtype of glial cells, have the ability to reach out, create dendritic spines that will uptake, you know, called phagocytosis, will uptake like cellular debris, it will uptake things and then retract their spines and sort of break up things that they find, usually like dying cells and things like that, because the microglial cells are dividing all the time and dying, and new ones are being born. And so there is a cell in the brain called a microglial cell that acts a little bit like a macrophage. And as far as it's known, that those cells respond to brain, you know, small-scale changes in the brain architecture and stuff like that. You can induce small-scale changes and watch these macrophages do that kind of stuff. And I bring that up because, as far as people can tell, in a healthy brain, the thing that the microglial cells are taking up, are not microbes. Right? There are other kinds of things.
So what do they uptake if not microbes?
Dead cells, cell debris.
Okay.
You know, things like that.
Okay.
Now, that being said, is there a possibility that there are resonant microbes in the brain that are there that are not dividing and dividing and dividing? And there are, I mean, like I said before, I think I mentioned before, that most bacteria are sort of known, at least like in laboratories, for dividing every 15 minutes, every 30 minutes, every 90 minutes. There are some bacteria, like some of them that are involved in gingivitis, that are there doing their thing, but they don't divide. like at that kind of speed. They're sort of constitutive. They're sort of resident bacteria.
So those cells, how long do they go without dividing?
I think it's environment dependent.
Okay.
I mean, I think if they're fed the right protein mixtures, you can induce them to divide. And some of that happens like in aging. It's like one reason gingivitis is associated with aging kind of stuff. I'm not an expert in this, but sort of brought to my attention that can be the case a little bit. But is there any evidence that you have some resident microbes that are not dividing that are in the brain? And today's point, there is no evidence of a brain microbiome in healthy tissue, which is sort of the punchline that remains to be seen. And that's not just in human healthy tissue. As I would argue, even in the animal models of it, which you would think a better place to study this stuff, where you can control for a lot of the variables, there's no evidence that they're there in the healthy brain. But you make a very good point. It doesn't mean that the brain is unresponsive to body microbiomes, because it's clear that the brain is responsive to the microbiome of the gut. There's bidirectional communication there. What's happening in your nervous system can influence. There can be, like I said, the vagus nerve is bidirectional. The vagus nerve can send signals to your gut that can influence what the microbes are doing. Samely, what the microbes are doing, or the immune response to them, is signaled back up to the brain through what's called retrograde transport.
So let's go a little more broad. So Instead of talking about the brain, what about the cranium inside the skull? At all?
No, that is the brain. Well, not everything in the brain is the cranium, because your brain is not a solid organ. There are ventricles in it, so you have a circulation of cerebral spinal fluid that's made in the ventricles and sort of pushed out. There's a lymphatic system of the brain that seems to be it's like the lymphatic system of the brain that seems to be most active in pulse during slow wave sleep. There's fluid flushing around your brain and through your brain all the time.
The question was, are there microbes that live on the inside of the skull and that they could possibly affect the brain?
Well, the stuff that's inside the skull is outside the brain.
Right, but it is very close to the brain. So could there be some sort of effect?
There could be, but no one's been able to find that yet.
Okay, so not yet.
Your brain is surrounded not just by the blood-brain barrier, but these things called the meninges. The dura mater, the subarachnoid space, and the pia mater, where these are cellular layers, and there's cerebral spinal fluid in the middle that sort of are separate between the brain and your skull, right? So is it possible to have an infection if it's on your skin, obviously it's outside the brain, but can you have an infection like underneath the bone, but before you get to the brain tissue? Absolutely. And sometimes that's called there's different kind of hematomas and stuff.
Okay.
So if some of the blood vessels burst, you could have an epidural hematoma those are usually blood that fill up.
And that's also disease related, which isn't what we're talking about.
No.
Right?
No. Yeah, that would usually happen after a head trauma or riding a roller coaster too many times, or you falling off your skateboard or something like that.
No hematoma from that yet.
Yeah, good. We don't want that.
So are there any other organs that are sort of microbiome free under normal conditions?
Yes. The one that comes to my mind right away is a placenta.
Okay.
Because people were interested in that. Do microbes have a role in embryological development?
Which they do.
Well, the placenta is, there's no evidence that there is a microbiome of the placenta. Mm-hmm. So it is, in a sense, a sterilized, I mean, it's not sterile because there's cells and things living in there, but it's actually another kind of immune-privileged organ. And if you think of what has to happen when a mammal gets pregnant, you have all of a sudden not only foreign DNA, but these foreign cells to the mother that are in there and they're dividing over and over and over again. Well, normally what happens if you put foreign cells into a critter is that the immune system will recognize the foreign cells and destroy them, and which would be counterproductive in terms of evolution for animals that have internal fertilization. And so the reproductive unit, which is the placenta, this temporary endocrine organ that develops, is sort of separated from the immune system of of the mother's body, which is appropriate for what has the growth that has to happen.
But the placenta is affected. It's at least like the development of an embryo, like in terms of the placenta, is affected by the general microbiome.
Well, the development of what's happening inside the placenta is affected by everything that's happening to the maternal organism. So if the maternal organism is fighting an infection, right? It's not that the microbes are going to get into the placenta. It's the response, it's the highly activated immune response and some of the cytokines and the chemokines that are produced by the immune response that can have an effect on placental development. And some people think that that results in things like higher incidences of schizophrenia and stuff like that, which is the most common, so you're nodding, that's the most common context that's talked about. But that's like stress and infection in mothers influencing the development of the fetal tissue. It doesn't mean the microbes or things that are doing it. It's like the effects on fetal development could be indirect.
Because I had a great little picture on an exam I had yesterday, and it said, here is it was some sort of computer generated image of a rat placenta when the mother was with the microbiome versus without a microbiome. Mm-hmm. And the vasculature of the without the microbiome was like very minimized compared to the with the microbiome. The placenta was a lot more vascular.
So are you surprised that an animal having an immune response like swelling is going to have increased vascularization?
Oh no.
That's exactly what happens like on your skin if you have an infection. What happens? You have increased vascularization because you have not only do you have more blood going there, but you have more lymphatic drainage going in there. Mm-hmm. That's going to increase the diameter of the vesicles, blah, 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 blah. That's why people take antihistamines because the histamines produced by mast cells and stuff like that recruit more cells, recruit complement and all that stuff there, and things blow up. And so the fact that the same thing can happen in the blood supply of the placenta
makes sense.
To me is not surprising, mm-hmm. if that's the picture that you drew for me. Unfortunately, Dan, we are running out of time on this segment of Health 411. This is 107.7 The Bronx and 1077thebronx.com. We're recording from the Digital Bronx Studios. Thank you for listening to Dan and I's conversation about the possibility of the brain microbiome or a brain microbiome. This program is part of Capital Health and Rider's efforts to bring people together to address all sorts of cool topics like this possibility of a brain microbiome. If you have questions and or comments about this program or want to make suggestions for future broadcasts, please email us at health411@rider.edu.
Remember, you have a doctor's appointment scheduled for every Sunday at 10 a.m. Don't miss the all-new Health 411 with Dr. Jonathan Karp and our expert medical guest from Capital Health. You can listen to Health 411 anytime on demand. Go to 1077thebronx.com/health411 to listen to past episodes or tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. to hear the weekend rewind edition of Health 411. Health 411 on 1077 The Bronx is underwritten by Capital Health, Minds Advancing Medicine. Capital Health is the region's leader in providing progressive quality patient care with exceptional physicians, nurses, and staff, as well as advanced technology.